Hello, it's Monday, September the 29th. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, British taxpayers to buy out another failed financial institution.
They've just got the chief executives and representatives of the six biggest banks into Downing Street over the weekend, asked them all, come on, one of you chaps, buy it. None of them has done so.
The American taxpayers to bail out billions in bad debts.
There was deep concern from Democrats as well as Republicans about the idea of putting one man, the Treasury Secretary, now Hank Paulson, in charge of $700 billion.
The Tories talk themselves up in Birmingham and Lewis Hamilton's F1 drive in the dark. First, here's today's headlines and a look at the papers.
In the United States, leaders of Congress have managed to hammer out a deal to spend $700 billion on a bailout for the banks. The government will buy up the bad debts from the housing market. The hope is that this move will stabilize the stock and money markets. The Speaker of the lower house of Congress, Nancy Pelosi, said that the original government offer had not had proper oversight and gave the Treasury Secretary uncontrolled powers. The deal took all weekend to finalize.
Again, working in a bipartisan way, we sent a message to Wall Street. The party is over. The era of golden parachutes for high-flying Wall Street operators is over. No longer will the U.S. taxpayer bail out the recklessness of Wall Street. And that's the news that this legislation brings.
That was Nancy Pelosi. Congress will debate the new bill today, and the Senate should be able to have their turn on Wednesday. We'll have more on this story later in Guardian Daily. In Britain, there's to be another bank buyout of the biggest buy-to-let lender, Bradford & Bingley. But the Chancellor has managed to find yet another bank prepared to take over part of the business. The Spanish bank Santander will buy the local branch offices and the savings part of the business, while the government will take over the mortgages. On the continent, they've also had to take urgent action to support their financial institutions. The Belgian government has joined with their Dutch and Luxembourg colleagues to rescue the financial group Fortis, which is Belgium's biggest employer. The three governments will put nearly £10 billion into the company to keep it afloat. The Conservative Party conference enters its second day in Birmingham, where their leader David Cameron told them that the country's financial crisis could be laid at the door of Gordon Brown because he'd spent the country's savings. Today, our correspondent Nick Watt tells us they're going to make an important policy announcement about the environment.
They are going to announce that if they win the next election, they are going to scrap the controversial third runway at Heathrow Airport and tempt airline passengers away from high-polluting internal flights onto the rail network. And they're going to do that by saying that they would be prepared to spend £15.6 billion over 12 years to build a new high-speed rail network that would link London St Pancras to Birmingham, Manchester and Leeds. And the Conservatives are saying that that could lead to a reduction of 66,000 flights a year from Heathrow, which would be 44% of the capacity of the planned new third runway at Heathrow. And they would say there is therefore no reason for that third runway at Heathrow.
That was Nick Watt. And we'll hear more from Birmingham shortly. The Tories only managed to get onto one of the front pages of the papers. The Guardian has that story by Nick Watt. Otherwise, it's city gloom and bailouts that dominate. The Times says that taxpayers must risk billions for Bradford and Bingley, while the Telegraph calls it Britain's toxic bank and the Mail superbank of bad debt. The Sun looks at it all sideways, having found a group of wealthy Barclays bankers on a lavish jaunt to the French Riviera. Not much room on the back pages for our continuing sporting success, Lewis Hamilton, who holds his place in the lead of the Drivers' Cup after finishing third in the nighttime Singapore Grand Prix. Instead, it's the gloom at Tottenham Football Club that takes the space after they lost again. Rock bottom, says The Independent. Broken spurs, says The Telegraph, saying it's the club's worst league start for 53 years, even though they've spent £77 million on new players. More news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
First, two major chunks of the mortgage market are further down the road to disappearing as the government finalises plans to nationalise the Bradford and Bingley. Investors who entered the buy-to-let mortgage market and those who self-certified may find it tough to remortgage when their current deals end, as the BNB, the biggest provider of such deals, calls for a £40 billion buyout from the government. The Guardian's financial editor Nils Prattley tells us what the deal means for UK taxpayers.
We assume that Bradford & Bingley will be taken over at 0p, in other words, the shareholders will be wiped out. What is going to happen is the bank, it looks as if the bank will be divided into two parts, the retail deposit base and the branches, and maybe a few of the quality mortgages will be sold on. The rest of the bank, which is the bulk of its £40 billion mortgage book, will be managed by the state, by the taxpayer. So ultimately, the cost of the taxpayer will be determined by how much of those mortgages are repaid in full.
Do we know whether the government is going to run the business or run down the business? Because if it does that, it's going to leave a large hole in the mortgage market, isn't it? Those people with a buy-to-let, for example, are going to find it very difficult to remortgage.
Well, the clear indication is that the government is going to run down the business, i.e. it's not going to get into the business of writing new mortgages. That at least seems to be the perception now. So running down the mortgage book it essentially means just taking over, making sure that people are keeping up with their payments, and where they're not, taking a view on what action needs to be taken, even up to the point of repossessing. Clearly, for housing associations and so on that had been quite reliant on Bradford & Bingley as a provider of mortgages, there is a big problem created because a big lender has just gone out of the market. So a question for the government is it going to do something to try and stimulate that market? Because it's quite hard to see what it could do just on its own back.
This is also going to lead to downward pressure on house prices, isn't it?
You would have thought so. You would have thought so because, I mean, Bradford & Bingley was only the eighth largest bank. It's a tiddler in some terms, but it is quite important to some parts of the market, buy-to-let. So you'd have thought there would be less buy-to-let activity, which in itself does create downward pressure on house prices.
Talk to us about demutualisation. The BNB is the last demutualised building society. They've either collapsed or been bought up by larger institutions.
Yeah.
Does this mean the whole thing was a failure?
I think it does mean the whole thing was a failure, yes. I mean, I can't remember how many there were of them, maybe seven or eight of these building societies converted. This is the last one standing as an independent, demutualised entity. I think the problem was that they were trying to do too much on too small a deposit base. They entered the wholesale market, they provided their funding to write mortgages from the wholesale market, and that ultimately has left them vulnerable. Northern Rock and Bradford and Bingley, most spectacularly so. So I think ultimately the experiment was a failure.
So last demutualised building society or bank, but what about the last bank to be bailed out by the government? Are there any more likely?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, clearly we would hope that this is the last one. And Northern Rock and Bradford and Bingley were the most exposed by some degree. Alliance and Leicester, you would have said, was the next, but that's been taken over by Santander. The big one was Halifax. That's the one that was troubling the government most of all. That has now been going to be taken over by Lloyds TSB. So really, there shouldn't be any more big problems. There shouldn't be. But ultimately, the pace at which this financial and banking crisis is moving is that anything seems possible. In America, we've seen really very big institutions like Washington Mutual fail, and lots of rumours about even bigger ones.
You mentioned the takeovers. Is the government hoping that this is just going to be a short-term bailout for the Bradford and Bingley, and somebody like Santander might actually come along in a few months' time and buy out their shares?
Well, I think the hope is that straight away that Santander or somebody buys the branches and the retail deposit base. I don't think the government holds up much short-term hope that anybody wants to take on the management and to buy the most troubling bit, which is the big loan book. I mean, if anybody does, great, but they've just got the chief executives and representatives of the six biggest banks into Downing Street over the weekend, asked them all, come on, one of you chaps, buy it, and none of them has done so.
Meanwhile, American taxpayers have their own banks to bail out. Congress has been finalising the wording of a deal to inject $700 billion of US taxpayers' money into its banking system. That's more than $2,000 for every man, woman and child in the country. With the details on how the scheme will work, here's The Guardian's US correspondent, Suzanne Goldenberg.
The deal that we expect to come out of the negotiations in Congress differs from the earlier one in several key respects. The main thing that members of Congress demanded to see was greater accountability. There was deep concern from Democrats as well as Republicans about the idea of putting one man, the Treasury Secretary, now Hank Paulson, in charge of $700 billion. So there's going to be a greater degree of oversight now. We are going to see that money paid out in installments. That's the money that will be used to buy distressed securities. There's also going to be measures put in place to try and protect homeowners. Another crucial aspect of this deal is that there are going to be curbs put on pay packages for Wall Street executives so that taxpayer money isn't used to give golden handshakes to the people on Wall Street who brought this crisis into being. And the final aspect here has to do with demands from Republicans as well as Democrats that there be some mechanism by which the taxpayer could benefit if indeed, you know, this buyout sort of ends in a profit for the government. So that's one other aspect that's being worked out, the final new measure that we're seeing in the deal.
Well, let's talk briefly about that last point. The taxpayer, will it then own a share in the banks that they are bailing out?
We haven't seen clear details of this agreement yet. So far as anybody knows, it was reached late on Saturday night, after midnight on Saturday night, and it was a verbal agreement. The negotiators spent most of Sunday working out the written details. We expect that there will be measures for the Treasury Department to purchase some of these distressed securities and to hold them.
You mentioned as well the pay limits for the executives. Have they put a figure on that?
We haven't seen anything in writing about that. It seems to me that what we're now seeing is an agreement in principle that there should be some kind of curbs on compensation for Wall Street executives. Basically, what we're seeing here is that Congress has put much more restraint and oversight on this package than it was originally conceived. When it sort of first emerged nearly 2 weeks ago, really there was no talk whatsoever coming out of the White House about any possible limits on pay for Wall Street. There was no mention of relief for homeowners or of programs that would enable people to stay in their homes and to put off foreclosure. That wasn't anything that was even in consideration. Those measures are now, we believe, going to be in the bill that will be put before the House of Representatives later on Monday. So while a lot of the details of this new agreement are vague and still have to be worked out, even they, you know, have yet to be committed to paper, what it represents really is quite an important shift in the perception of this bailout package towards greater accountability and towards relief, not just for companies on Wall Street, but for ordinary Americans.
And can you explain for us those homeowners who were facing foreclosure? How does this package help them stay in their homes? Because they've still got to pay the same bills, haven't they?
We are still not clear on the details of how people will be able to stay in their homes. There is going to be a greater compulsion on the banks to try and come to agreements for repayment plans by homeowners who have, you know, fallen behind on their payments, who have not been able to meet their payments. You know, in the past, we've seen a lot of complaints coming out from people who say that the banks are unresponsive, that they haven't allowed them to come to some kind of agreement that would enable them to pay off their loans. And the pressure now in this bill will be to make sure that the banks and mortgage lenders do that.
The Guardian's Suzanne Goldenberg. Also on The Guardian's website today, US troops have a permanent presence in Israel. The story at guardian.co.uk/world. The credit crunch hits the aristocracy as they look to auction off dinner with the Lord of the Manor. That's at guardian.co.uk/society. Find out why the MOD has ordered 600 new armoured cars. Those details at guardian.co.uk/politics. And Margaret Rutherford and the missing Oscar. guardian.co.uk/culture. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come in today's programme, F1's Night on the Town with Hamilton on the podium at Singapore's first ever floodlit Grand Prix.
I think we might well see more of this. I spoke to Bernie Eccleston yesterday on this subject and he said, you know, I would like to see China and Japan both have night races.
First, Birmingham will be crawling with Conservative MPs this week, not something you would normally hear, as the city plays host to the Tory conference. We've heard opening speeches by the party leader David Cameron and London Mayor Boris Johnson. More now from our political team in what many locals refer to as the UK's second city.
This is Michael White at the International Convention Centre in downtown Birmingham, which has been patting itself on the back all day about what a great city it is, and a nice city it is too. But that wasn't the big story, of course. The big story is the economy, the global economy. And David Cameron's here, acutely aware that he's got to tread on eggshells this week. He mustn't seem triumphalist, he mustn't gloat too much about Gordon Brown's problems, and he must convince voters, as he explained to the conference this afternoon, that the Tories are a credible, coherent, united opposition with some good answers to the kind of problems which are worrying voters at home.
It's not just that we have to win so many constituencies to become the next government. It's that we have to win so many people's trust about how we will be able to take this country forward. So no complacency is vital this week.
Well, the Tories, if you remember, had a terrific conference last year. They wrong-footed Gordon Brown over tax, inheritance tax and other nonsense, and put him on the back foot, made him blink and postponed the election he was thinking of having, although he was never made up mind about it. It was people around him who said, go on, do it, Gordon, and Brown sensibly didn't. But nonetheless, great conference for the Tories. This year they're not going to be able to do as well as that, although they'll certainly try. The big thing is not to make mistakes, not to sound complacent, not to sound arrogant, not to crow too much, not to make mistakes. And there's a good reason for that, because they know, and the weekend polls have shown this, Brown's come back 10% in the polls. He's over 30%. He's been on 24 months. Three polls have got him back over 30. The gap has been halved. So David Cameron knows what all the pollsters have been telling him. It isn't a done deal with the voters. They look at him, and some of them say, he's a bit young, he's a bit inexperienced, not sure that I trust him, and that George Osborne, he looks as if he ought to be in school. And so Cameron has got to not lose ground. He's got to say enough things which are relevant to the big issue, mustn't score cheap party points. He's got to sound like a statesman and sound like someone who could cope with these terrible pressures which are bearing down on Gordon Brown.
And my message to Gordon Brown is this. You have had your boom and your reputation is now bust.
And here is what some of the party delegates, not me, what the delegates, except they call themselves representatives. Here's what the representatives themselves think.
He first of all, I think, needs to seriously address crime and disorder. He certainly needs to address the high cost of government and bureaucracy, where you've got God knows how many benefits being dished out to people. We need perhaps a new unified benefit system, because each benefit costs to give, and if a family's receiving seven or eight different benefits, then it's costing seven or eight times as much as giving one unified benefit.
Tax cuts, but when we can afford them, we do realise that there's the credit crunch, which is global, which could have been. I know that global things affect us anyway, but I think things could be managed much better by our government anyway, because of you know, the banks misbehave here. Of course, the problem, well, is government should be keeping an eye on them.
Certainly, I think we've got an excellent leader in David Cameron, and I'm looking forward to hearing more of what he has to say. But obviously something about the present financial crisis, and then also something about how the Conservatives would move forward in the field of foreign affairs, where I think the country's in a real mess at the moment.
There is justifiable fury at some of the bankers who flogged these mortgages. But I have to tell you, it worries me when I hear a Labour government that inflated the bubble, that stoked the debt, that schmoozed the financiers, that shamelessly slaughtered sacred socialist cows on the smoking altars of the Temple of Mammon, suddenly deciding it would be popular to punish the capitalists and bring in new regulations to fetter the banks. Because I don't believe that the best way of protecting the hard-working mortgage holders of London is to launch a vindictive attack on one of the most successful industries in this country.
We were all watching Boris, because Boris was like that admiral in World War I who could have lost the entire fleet and therefore the entire war in an afternoon. Some Dumbo remark by Boris. I thought he got fairly close to it. He kept on saying, you know, it's the money all these guys in the city makes which keeps the city afloat. Well, yeah, they do make money, but they... lose quite a lot of money too, and at the moment they're losing it all. So Boris came close to embracing the city just at a time when voters don't want the city to be embraced. I listened with one ear to the back end of his speech. I think it's all right. We didn't have a Boris explosion, but you can never be sure, and at Labour headquarters they'll be going through every line of Boris and every line of what everybody else says here, because they're looking for ways in which they can say to the voters, you can't trust them yet.
And there's more on the Conservatives at guardian.co.uk/politics. To Singapore now, where there is no credit crunch. And while the financial world develops a list of firsts, the motoring world has now witnessed the first nighttime race. Lewis Hamilton managed to stay out of trouble to claim a place on the podium. Alan Henry is in Singapore for The Guardian. He tells us what he thinks about the experience.
What started as an idea which was purely a commercial imperative, that's to say making sure the races are being held by prime time in Europe, has turned into a bigger, far bigger success than we could have ever imagined. I think it's been hugely welcomed in this part of the world, and the Formula One community has embraced it with open arms.
Is it just a novelty, or do you think we're going to see more of this?
I think we might well see more of this. I spoke to Bernie Eccleston yesterday on this subject, and he said, you know, I would like to see China and Japan both have night races, but of course, you know, considerations like the duration of their current contracts, and obviously something as fundamental as this could only be initiated elsewhere when the race contracts come up for renewal.
Let's talk about the race then. Lewis Hamilton stayed out of trouble this time, no penalties attached.
No, absolutely. Qualified second, ran second in the early stages. Looked as though he was going to have his hands full dealing with both the Ferraris. But on a day that the Ferraris self-destructed, Hamilton missed every problem and drove very well. Very much a tactical race. He said before he started that he wasn't going to take huge risk, and it was very much a strategic race. Once he got to third place, he wasn't about to risk a collision with Nico Rosberg battling over second.
And Fernando Alonso won. I guess we should give him a mention, ending a frustrating season so far.
Absolutely. Of course, he fell out with McLaren at the end of last year, and a lot of people predicted he might never win another Grand Prix again. And certainly the Renault hasn't been a front-running car all season, but on an occasion like this where a bit of improvisation and driver experience plays premiums, he came home and delivered.
And some drama in the pits for Felipe Massa.
Absolutely. Ferrari had a bad year. This is the third such drama in the pit lane over only a few races. That was what happened. Was they have a very complicated and sophisticated system of lights that will signal the drivers to leave the pits, and they are automatically electronically linked to the refueling nozzle. So when the mechanic turns the refueling nozzle to release it from the side of the car, the light goes to green and the driver accelerates away. On this occasion, because of strategic considerations and the fact that Raikkonen was immediately behind Massa in the pit lane in the other Ferrari queuing to refuel, they overrode the electronic signalling system and reverted to a manual system controlled by one of the mechanics. Unfortunately, pressed the go button a little bit too soon, and we all saw the consequences. Massa accelerate down the pit lane with his tail hanging out behind him.
And I did notice from looking at the footage, one of the pit crew was knocked over, wasn't he?
He was indeed. He was shaken, but happily no broken bones. He went to the medical centre, and he's okay.
Let's finish off with the tables for the Drivers' World Championship. Hamilton now has a 7-point lead.
Absolutely, with 30 points to play for. Still very open, you'd have to say. Three races in Japan, China and Brazil. Still everything to play for.
And your predictions?
I think Hamilton will do it.
The Guardian's Alan Henry. That's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. It was produced by Roxanne Escobales and Tim Mabey. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.